This double issue of Audio Arts, recorded at Documenta 8 in Kassel, West Germany, comprises interviews, statements, and commentary, juxtaposed with audio reportage of sound works, installations, and local ambience. And in fact, we're standing now in Der Karlkirche in Kassel, listening to a piece by John Cage. And I thought it might be interesting, Mike, to speculate about the show that we're about to look at and spend a few days walking round. I mean, do you have any particular expectations of this documenta?
Well, really all I've got to go on at the moment is what's been written in the advanced publicity, which says that the main theme of the shows revolves around the idea that there could be some kind of social function for art. And Manfred Schneckenberger, who's the main organizer this time, explains that as being in some way a kind of reaction to Documenta 7, which was much more concerned with sort of art for art's sake. And I think in some senses he's going to try and hark back to Documenta 6, which he also organized, where there was much more emphasis on performance and real-time work. I think this time there'll be probably a much more conscious effort to relate art to a number of other practices, notably architecture and design, in which the kind of functions that those two perform will be seen in relation to the sorts of visual aspects of some contemporary art which makes reference to them.
Well, the first artist that we're going to talk to is Anthony Gormley, who is showing work in the Frederikianum, which along with the Orangerie are the two principal exhibition spaces here. Anthony, we're in your space here in the Frederikianum in Documenta, and in fact it appears to be something of a passage in a sense. I mean, you've got three pieces installed here. I mean, to what extent did you determine the space that you're showing in?
Well, originally I asked for a space with one entrance so the works could be self-contained. I didn't get it, and I got this space. And I think what I'm trying to do here is still retain the idea of the integrity of the space in spite of the kind of interruption of people walking through it. And I think the point of the work is as always, to try and balance the sense of an enclosed space under compression within the lead skins with the space that the objects occupy.
Right.
And I think it doesn't work, like at the moment when you've got a solid stream of people cutting the room in half. It just doesn't work. But at moments, perhaps when the rain stops outside and people go back to drinking coffee in the cafes and it is a bit quieter, I think that, well, now, for instance, now it's empty. It begins to come back.
Did you actually make the pieces that we see for this space, or were they pieces already in existence?
I'd already begun To the Ends of the Earth when I was invited to be in Documenta, and I felt they were appropriate works to show. I mean, I then went on with the other two works with a strong view to them being shown together.
And in fact, two pieces, one that you've just mentioned and another one leaning up against the wall to our left, seem to almost be sort of three-dimensional mirror images of each other.
They're double figures, one that lies on its side with the two figures pointing outwards, each lying on its side. And the other, the one that's leaning up against the wall, is two figures facing each other, with the heads and shoulders pulled apart. In both of them, I'm trying something which I've never tried before, which is really to give an idea of separation within one object. Mm. The idea of division in unity, the idea of perhaps the fact that we all come from the dividing of a cell, that there is something that is both part of our physical beings and also part of our mental beings that has to do with division, whether that's the division of our brains, whether the fact that we are divided into male and female, whether there are tensions within us towards the pull of external action and internal realization. And those tensions, I think, are what I'm trying to touch on in these pieces. Right. And I think they're very. I mean, for me, it was important. I mean, what I have never done before is allow the structure of the axes, the way that the surface is divided into strong horizontal and vertical sections. Previously, in almost all of my work, that's existed within the axes of the architecture, and there's been a strong theatrical presentation, usually with a figure centrally placed in a room. With this, I've made a much more casual installation, with the works just kind of, as it were, rolled into the space. They don't have that kind of theatrical authority. And as a result, I think the works invite one to use them as mental containers in a far less confrontational way. And I thought that was, well, for me, a big step, because it means that the potential for the works to be redundant is far greater. I mean, they can just be ignored. But what it, by doing that, I think I kind of introduce the question of how art is to be used. I allow that to be introduced into the consciousness of the viewer.
Well, there are a couple of things that struck me immediately when I saw the pieces. First, which is something you've just touched on, which is the way in which the lead encases the forms is divided much more than it seems to me you've done in the past. The way that, for example, with this one that's leaning, all of the strips are quite narrow and vertically oriented, and in the one that's lying on the floor, there's a very small network of squares over the whole form. And again, which goes back to what you were trying to say just then, the way that this one is leaning against the wall, which is a much more casual kind of placement than other pieces of yours that I've seen, which do relate the wall and the floor of a space. For example, the one with you where you were, as it were, bolted to the wall, coming straight out just above the floor. With this one, there is again that kind of connection.
I think I'm doing that, but I'm doing it in a different way. I mean, I think it isn't as theatrical as that piece. I mean, I am still talking about what is it, this space that we occupy with the work, and how can sculpture make us more physically aware of the conditions of our life, which may just be within this room. You know, what is the difference between stillness and movement? I mean, I hope what I'm getting to is a kind of concretion of mind and matter that has to do with very basic things to do with existence.
Do you think very much in a kind of concrete way about the relationship between the actual space within the museum or gallery that you're installing in and outside that space?
I want this room to be the beginning of everywhere. The way that I use the body is not as a, it's not a portrait or a history of one man's life. It's the idea of a body as a membrane on which all the forces of the world are acting upon. And in a sense, if one can use the invitation of the work to feel through one's own physical body as a person that stands outside them but with them, that connection, then I think the work is beginning to function.
Can I ask you finally about the central argument then for this documenta, Documenta 8, which is concerned with a sort of a social legibility? I mean, how do you feel about that theme, that argument, in relation to your work here?
Well, I think the problem is that maybe Documenta and a vast international show like this may not be the best instrument for this kind of thesis. I mean, it seems to me that the best way of involving art with real issues in the world is to actually make permanent or perhaps temporary works that actually are in the real world and exist in the street. I sort of feel that it's an argument being put forward in the wrong place, perhaps. And the strange thing is that what the overall feeling, which should be creative and utopian, ends up being a very designed feeling in this show. That in some way it should be radical, but it ends up being bureaucratic.
Could I ask then just finally about another context in which you've recently placed some work, which is as part of the TSWA project, where you've also got a double figure back to back standing on Derry City walls. How did you feel about that context?
Well, for me that's the most exciting thing that I've done so far with my life and my work, simply because it's a chance to use art as a part of a process of change, perhaps, but not. I don't see that as being utopian. I mean, I have placed art in a tragic situation of human conflict, where by touching on the divisions within a single community, by making an image about that, I hope that I can draw towards the work some of the feelings that might find other means of expression. And I hope that also within the work there is an implicit sense of resolution. While there is an acknowledgement of division, there is also within the work an implicit unity. And I've used there the image of a crucified man. The two men are crucified to each other. I mean, signifying very obviously the Protestant and Catholic split community. But the work is a mould that indicates one space, and I think reactivates the image of redemption through suffering.
This is an installation by Marcel Odenbach. It's essentially two monitors at the end of a room about 20 feet by 10, and on the monitor from which the sound is coming that can be heard is a split screen with a division down the center in black and white of a figure running, and either side of that there are images of a classical interior with people walking through, rather like a
interior of a stately home or a palace. Now, the other monitor at the other end of the room is another split screen, this side with a black and white image either side of it of architectural subjects, and in the centre is a colour strip with two 18th century figures walking through a park.
Ja. Mr. Evans, ist Mr. Stevenson jetzt zu sprechen?
Noch nicht, der kommt erst am Sonntag zu.
So haben Sie lange an Versailles gedacht, bis Sie hier leben konnten?
Gehen Sie nicht weg, ich brauche Hilfe, bitte.
Nein.
Bitte gehen Sie nicht, hören Sie mich. So hören Sie mich doch.
So habe ich lange in Versailles verkehren müssen. Sanssouci zu verstehen.
Maria, we're standing in a park opposite the Fredericianum here in Kassel at Documenta, and we're looking at a piece that you've installed here called Two Mirrors and Two Doors. Perhaps you could describe it.
Well, it's also called City Talks, and its time of making is 10 years because it connects to an earlier work that was placed on the street at the Frankfurter and Hecker Street here in Kassel. And it was a small store with two transparent doors. So when I came here, I measured the same doors this year and I asked them to build them as mirrors on the facade so that the light of the facade that's, would be thrown back on the place. And that the focus of the two mirrors would occur at a certain time and a certain point, but that the light would wander across the place as coherently with the people, so that the discussions that take place here are finally the work.
Right. Mark, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, when the helicopter goes overhead a bit, yeah. Well, for me, It's a work that reminded me, as soon as I came to this focal point, which is an octagonal stone set into the grass in the middle of the city square. As you walk up to it, you don't realize why it's where it is, but as soon as you're actually in it or on it, on this stone, which is glistening bright marble, the light changes completely, and at that point you suddenly realize why you are where you are, because it's a focal point. And for me, it reminded reminded me of Delphi in Greece, which is the omphalos, the navel of the world. And it's not actually until you go up to the top of the site at Delphi that you realize why Delphi is placed where it is. And there's a certain moment where it becomes a kind of focal point. And it's also like, in that sort of sense, something like Stonehenge, that you come up to it and you don't... It looks like a nondescript sort of area. And suddenly you're on top of it and it's... That's why you are where you are.
This sound installation by Julius, recorded with local ambience, takes the form of concealed loudspeakers placed high up in the facade of a 19th century building next to the Fredericianum. In the next item, Helen and Newton Harrison talk about their environmental work for Kassel.
Yes, please.
So, essentially, we develop a work out of the environment into which we are cast in a city or an environment, and we look around and see what strikes us. We have the advantage of the stranger always to see with new eyes, and the disadvantage of the stranger, so that we must connect with local people to, of course, gain information and gain the common knowledge, you know, and find out what everybody knows, which goes... But anyway, our first impressions began with looking at Castle and at the center, which is penalized in winter and in rain by its structure. It's lessened by detachment from its history, imprisoned by the barrier of the perimeter road, impoverished by the uniformity of information and the brevity of the central axis, and threatened by the significance of the absence of the stork. So that tells very much the whole story. And then we begin, and each of the large images that you see is a chapter, ending with the large image you asked us about first. And first, we propose the fact that Castle is problems in winter and in rain, and winter is long and the rains are many. And so we propose building shelters scattered through along the central axis. Yes. And you see them behind the buildings, not interfering with the existing promenade, which is a very successful one, but going through the backs of buildings and over open spaces so that there becomes a second route to go through for the weather, and also scattering in other places. Then we take a look here, and we see that a forgetting has taken place. Castle has forgotten its history. At the point, the castle began as a small settlement on the river, and then became a place where during Carolingian times, where the king would wander and hold court in his various areas, and of course it was a seat of the royal court for a time. But all of this occurred here beside the river, the place of earliest settlement. But what was done was to build these huge roads next to the river, cutting people off from the possibility of relating to this early time, and then building other buildings, of course large buildings on the area, all of which block the river, and all of which block the sense of history. They're uncovering, here it's a beautiful area here in an old rondel, part of an old fort. They uncovered a second round tower, and they're busy covering it up again instead of digging it up and, you know, trying to renovate instead of building up the old Rudekirke, the first church here, and showing, you know, what it was like there, covering it up, so that the city itself becomes isolated from its history.
Okay. If we pick up from the sort of almost willful alienation from its past and the center endangering the perimeter, then you say, well, what's a nice person to do about all this stuff? And the real issue for us then would be that if the information is weak in the center about its past, it's equally weak in the center about its future. And so rather than doing remediation, we then pick up a whole new idea. Wherein we propose what we call a garden of extreme measures so that the community can predict its future by what happens in such a garden. And the fundamental thing in this garden is another kind of a remembering, an ecological remembering, where you and I can go down to the water and drink directly, which is not in people's physical memory who are under 50 or under 40 anyway.
Right. It's as if you're peeling off layers.
That's correct.
Of kind of covered things up to get back to something that's much more fundamental and important in a way. Right. So do the works, which in their form appear to be proposals in a sense, I mean, are they works that could actually be carried out in the plan?
Well, we're not utopians.
Yes.
This is in German, but it lays out the basic cost. We commissioned a cost analysis. Comes out to be about $1 million American to do the garden, and probably another million to make the connections.
Right.
And that's not much.
So the main development would be in this area of land over the other side of the river, which at the moment is wasteland.
Well, it's used for park.
It's used to have fairs.
Fairground.
Yes.
But there are other fairgrounds just as good. Yes. And the cost would be to build a bridge, to build another bridge, to scatter shelter along the way, to set up a connection where there was a joyous walk, a walk of the
river. And to build an extraordinary new kind of garden, which would be actually a water purification system that is really a work of art, that is a lovely place to go, and that functions, that also functions to protect endangered species of wet meadows and dry meadows, that ends up giving people, also would be a museum of ecological history there.
Yeah.
that would be a new forest and that would make people aware always of what is happening.
Right, and what has happened.
Well,
as a matter of interest, changing the subject, do you plan to make any works in England? Because I remember a piece you did at the Haywood Gallery.
The fish.
There was a little bit of trouble at the time, I seem to remember.
They never asked us back.
We have not been asked back to England since then.
Since that piece?
Yes.
Right, so from our point of view, we find that if we go somewhere, nobody wants to see us. But if somebody invites us, then things work out swell. And the only promise we make is the promise we made here. That is, we'll come there for 4 or 5 days and think. And then at a certain moment, a magical moment will happen. And then we'll sort of know what to do. And then we'll put one foot in front of the other.
Talking to Edward Fry, and perhaps we could start by you describing your role in Documenta 8.
I was present at the birth of Documenta 8, and I worked with the overall director, Manfred Schneckenberger, on every aspect of this exhibition. And in fact, Manfred and I were the only people working full-time on it for the last 2 years. My contributions were as follows. I helped to devise the general theory and concept of the exhibition, and I also was very involved at every stage with the selection of the artists and the installation of the exhibition.
Perhaps you could then go on to expand on what seems to be an underlying argument for this documenta, which is to do with the notion of art that has some sort of social placement and social location. I mean, how did that theme arise in the first place?
It arose in the following manner, as an attempt to resolve the dilemma of the postmodern, and as an attempt to rethink the nature of modernity in the context of the Enlightenment. Therefore, we examined very carefully the various historical and critical aspects of the entire modern tradition going back to the 18th century, and we began to realize that modernism, as we refer to it, is only a section of modernity as a whole, and that modernism, as we know it from, shall we say, Manet through to Surrealism or to Jackson Pollock, is a completed element. It is a finished story. And that an attempt to prolong its viability and to narrow and, shall we say, intensify aesthetically its heritage, the modern heritage, has resulted only in a kind of academy of the modern, an academy of modernism, in which the aesthetic takes an overwhelming role at the expense of all the other possible functions that art has played in our modern society since the beginning of the Enlightenment. And therefore, we decided that there was only two ways out of this postmodern dilemma. One would have been, shall we say, to go the inward subjective route into extreme subjectivity of psychological, psychiatric sorts of an inner universe. But that really has also been done very, very thoroughly in the last few generations. And then we decided that the only other way would be to go outward from art back into society and into an interaction with society, as art always has had. And then we realized that that has been attempted also recently, shall we say, as recently as the avant-gardism of Dada and Surrealism and certain aspects of conceptual art of the 60s. And then we realized that the answer to the dilemma of the postmodern is for art to enter into the social and intellectual space of the world without losing its identity as art. And that became our basis for building this exhibition. And we did it in two ways. Our first principle was to re-examine what we call the false autonomy of pure art, and to attempt to challenge that autonomy, or at least to throw it into relief as an unexamined principle which needs rethinking. And so we took lots of examples of, shall we say, pure form, and did something to those forms so as to depurify it, be it architecture, design, or all kinds of, shall we say, pure forms that can enter into social and personal experience. And then we also decided that on a symbolic or iconographic level, art could enter into direct relationship to the social world by a kind of critical re-representation of the world, so as to throw unacknowledged assumptions into relief and into clarity, be they certain myth structures or, shall we say, certain ways in which the visual has become all too instrumentalized and prostituted to the ends of the media and the so-called consciousness industry. And those became our two building blocks for this documenta.
You said, in theoretical terms, yesterday, you mentioned two figures. You were intending to oppose the kind of ideas of Habermas to those of Lyotard. Could you expand a little on what you mean by that?
What I meant by that particular opposition is this, that one of the subtexts of this documenta is a more or less outright rejection of the current situation of French aesthetic and critical theory as being in itself a kind of late surrealism or Dada, a kind of residue of earlier 20th century versions of French modernism, and in itself as a group of theories, perhaps an academy, in which the final point of reference is either always art for art's sake, or as a form of entertainment or spectacle. And I particularly cited Monsieur Lyotard because he strikes me as being perhaps one of the more convenient ways of making reference to some of the less desirable and unnecessary aspects of postmodern, which are disappearance of all substantive issues under surface effects and under style and aesthetics. The idea of Lyotard that, shall we say, the modern represents some kind of version of the sublime is, first of all, a gross error, because sublimity implies some kind of transcendence, and the very principle of the Enlightenment is secularization of consciousness away from transcendental principles. I could also have mentioned Baudrillard and Debord, all those people who are interested in a spectacle, the surface effects of life, whether they're describing the unhappy realities of the consciousness industry or something else. I would contrast, however, all that to what I consider the very intelligent insight of Jürgen Habermas, that the project of modernity is not over. The Enlightenment had its own tragedies of, shall we say, occasionally reason run mad, as in the era of the Terror of Robespierre, which is one of the really rather marvelous insights of Ian Hamilton Finlay's work here. But not only is the project of modernity not over, it has a long way to go. But if it does not have a long way to go, there is not much hope for us. Therefore, we decided that a development of some ideas implied but not developed in some of Jürgen Habermas's thinking and writings is a viable way out of the postmodern dilemma in both theory and cultural practice, because it is open-ended, and because it indicates that art is too important to be left to aesthetics, if we would like perhaps to take art seriously once again, instead of, shall we say, some kind of fetishized store of value for the bourgeoisie, or for the nouveau riche, or for the Saatchis, or somebody else, that's fine, but that's not really what modernity is about. And that's why I made that parallel, that juxtaposition, opposition. I could have mentioned other people in addition to Lyotard and some other people in addition to Habermas, but those are two clearly defined antitheses, antithetical positions.
Do you feel that in taking some of these forms and depurifying them, as you say, mm-hmm. taking architecture, taking mm-hmm. design and art and so on, that mm-hmm. there might be a danger that one would find it difficult to differentiate between the two, that in fact one is simply then thrown back into the realm of the aesthetic in enjoying them as spectacle, as design or art or whatever, and that what is specific to art and what is specific to design and what is specific to architecture might somehow in that depurification get lost.
Your point is well taken. I think architecture is in a sad way. I think architecture is capable of doing certain things as an art form that it alone has to do, but that it is not able to do the things that painting and sculpture can do, for example. It is always going to be an art of form, of symbolic abstract form. The point I think we try to encourage in our work with the architectural section, which interests me somewhat less than the rest of the exhibition, I might add, is to de-instrumentalize architecture as an art form, the most politically, socially, and economically compromised of any of the plastic arts by the sheer financial factors involved. And therefore we decided to think of, shall we say, the secularized version of the cathedral, which in our age is the museum, as a kind of topos, as a kind of tapas for the architects to try their hand with, to see what they would do, and in such a context they could reveal their own approach to the handling of symbolic forms in space. Partly successful, partly not. I am somewhat more curious about how the so-called design areas of this exhibition turned out. Some went rather better than others. I think in some cases, however, it looked a little bit like postmodern glitz and some kind of warmed-over version of neo-Bauhaus, but they may be happy exceptions. However, what we were trying to do is very hard to do. If you see sculptors abandoning autonomous form and functioning as, shall we say, sculptor architectonic artists, such as Armigiani and others, and you see architects giving up the, shall we say, exhausted modern paradigms of Bauhaus and moving desperately into, shall we say, stylistic eclecticism, there is the beginning of a convergence, which perhaps as a possible potential convergence has more meaning than any actual convergence might end up being.
if we could just talk a little bit about the design section, because this morning I spoke to Michael Erloff and also some of the people working there, and one of the things that came to mind was the way in which a number of those designers had in a sense adopted a sort of a fine art attitude to do with producing almost a piece of sculpture, although the relationship with something functional still stood. But the notion of production and of mass production and something produced relatively cheaply seemed to have gone from a lot of those objects. I mean, is that an issue, do you think, that's relevant?
I don't think it's a particularly interesting issue. You can end up having objet de luxe again, just with a lot of high style and high consciousness, like Milan in the 60s. I don't think that is particularly interesting or particularly close to the center of this documenta, I would have to say. Obviously, everyone wants to try his or her hand these days at designing a new chair or something like that. That's fine, but you can only get just so far with that.
Just another question about the artists that you've chosen or that have been chosen. Again, some of them seem to fit very much into the kind of argument of the exhibition. I'm thinking of Hans Hacker and Barbara Kruger, whereas others seem to be functioning as object makers in a fairly traditional sense. And one wondered how the two kinds of polarities connected with your argument.
They don't connect very well. There are only so many good social political artists in the world. We tried to include the best. We also tried to include some interesting examples of artists working in some kind of late modernist tradition who are in themselves also trying to change. One thinks, for example, of Robert Grosvenor, who was at one time a minimal sculptor, moving into metaphors of shelter, of Scott Burton working from minimalism toward chairs and benches, of Susanna Solano working away from, shall we say, the Chilita tradition of abstract formal sculpture towards something that has bodily or shall we say, human interactive metaphorical implications, or other examples like that.
I suppose always with attempting to make an argument that is concerned with issues in terms of the exhibition, where one is planning it and formulating it, and then when the exhibition happens, perhaps something else arises. I was just wondering whether, from your original intention to the actual realization of this documenta, whether you feel certain things have actually worked very well and other things haven't.
Oh, I think we got about 70% of what we wanted to do realized, which is a pretty high average when it comes to some sort of enormously complex world exhibition. And I think the installation gives an indication of our intentions also, with certain extreme concentrations of mental, physical force, such as sort of the juxtaposition between Sarah, Hacker, and Kruger, or the deliberate counterpointing of Robert Morris and Anselm Kiefer, which I find quite interesting in that Morris seems to attack the juggler of the nightmare of reason run mad in the Holocaust, whereas Kiefer seems to be flirting with a new version of proto-fascist sublimity. Overall, I would say that we have achieved a great many of our goals, one of which was that this would be a very critical exhibition in that it would be not affirmative of the art market, of the interests of private collectors, but in a sense to attempt to begin to redirect the very function of art in society.